I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. In her new biography of Babe Ruth, Jane Levy reminds us that in baseball, as the saying goes, the older you get, the better you used to be. The great Bambino still commands our interest and fascination nearly 100 years after his heyday. Ruth's impact on the game is unmistakable, but so is his lasting impact on American popular culture. The lodestar of American fame, as Levy calls him, who helped define the very notion of what celebrity has come to mean. When the Babe played, the world was transfixed on every swing, every miss, every home run, and every exploit off the field. The book is called The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created. Jane Levy joins me when Midday gets underway, right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. With the Super Bowl just a few days away, sports fans are edging ever closer to turning their gaze to baseball as soon as that little football game is over. Pitchers and catchers report to Orioles spring training in 2 weeks. Today, a conversation about one of the most fascinating figures, not only in baseball history, but in American history. Born and raised in Baltimore, he graduated from the School of Hard Knocks and evolved into the most famous man in America, whose every swing of the bat seemed to be a matter of national interest and whose every exploit off the field was a source of endless fascination for Depression-era fans. His influence and importance of the game, to the game, rather, is unquestioned. And because the timing of his rise to prominence coincided with an expansion of media from print to broadcast, his influence in the public sphere, well outside the diamond, was unprecedented. In her fascinating and granular look at the life of Babe Ruth, Jane Levy observes at some point in the trajectory of fame, real life becomes apocryphal. Home runs travel in perpetuity, drafting on perpetually willing suspension of disbelief. The temporal facts of biography no longer matter because everyone knows a person who can hit 60 home runs will live forever. Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs in the 1927 season, and we've been talking about him ever since. Levy asserts that our current notion of what it means to be a celebrity and what it means to be famous are inexorably shaped by the life and media circus that was the great Bambino. Her book is called The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created. Jane Levy joins me today here in Studio A. We'll take your calls and comments a little bit later in the show. In the meantime, we are streaming our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page. Jane Levy, it's good to see you.
Thank you, and thank you for saying my name right.
You know, and the first thing I have to apologize because in the promos for today's show, I was saying it wrong.
Well, let me just tell you, my grandmother went to her grave as Levy, so it's all right.
It's L-E-A-V-Y,
right?
But it's Levy.
And Billie right. Jean King used to call, for whom I once worked, used to call me Heavy Levy.
Heavy Levy.
And I called her Thunder Thighs.
Touche. Well, speaking of names, there's a great passage in your book in which you annotate many of the names that the Babe, Babe Ruth, of course, his name wasn't Babe. He was George Herman Ruth. But just lay on us a few of the ways that Babe Ruth was referred to.
Okay. He was the Babe. I have to do this. So I take a deep breath and see if I can do it in one breath, but I can't. There are 58 of them, and I've found 28 more since I accumulated this list. He was the Babe, the Bam, the Big Bam, the Great Bambino, or Slambino, the Bazoo of Bang and Bash, Behemoth of Biff, Bust, and Bangs, Blunderbuss, the Bulky Monarch and the Monarch of Swatdom, Caliph of Clout, Colossus of Club, and vice versa, the Circuit Smasher, Demon Swatter, Diamond Studded Ball Buster, His Eminence, the Priest of Swat, G. Herman Hercules and Pan Hercules, the Goliath of Grand Slam and Great Kegel of Clout, Hejaz of Hit, Herman the Great and Homeric Herman, Infant of Swatagy, that's my favorite, Kid of Crash, King of Clout, King of Swing, the Home Run King, the Maharaja and Mauler of Mash, the Mauling Menace, Monarch and Mastodon, also the Mandarin of Maul and Mastodonic Mauler, the modern Beowulf, Paladin of Punch, Prince of Ash and Potentate of Pounders, Raja of Rap, Sheik of Slam, Sockham of Slug, the Samson and Sultan of Swat, the Swattingest Swatter of Swatdom, the Terrible Titan and Titan of Thump, Wazir of Wham, Wally of Wallop, and Wizard of Whack, Jedge, George, the Big Fella. And all the names put together were still not enough to encompass the idea of him.
Yeah, the Infant of Swatigy. And you chose the Big Fella. There were a lot of people who did actually refer to him as that contemporaneously. He was a larger than life figure at the time, and he remains a larger than life figure. I mean, you refer to him as the lodestar of American fame. And so all those names, these are sports writers, you know, tripping over themselves to come up with something new, something different, something, you know, that will stand out of the crowd. So there's this, what comes through in this really terrific book is this, the confluence of what the media was becoming and this subject that they had laid in front of them on a golden platter.
He came to the absolute apex of his powers and his clout, as it were, at the precise moment in American history when mass media was being invented, when radio came into people's homes for the first time, when telexes and telegraphs could take more than 10 words at a time, when a first fax machine was invented in 1924, believe it or not, and the Chicago Tribune and the New York Daily News, sister publications, created a system called Telepix in January 1927 that enabled them to send a picture across the country. Yes, it was expensive, and it was reserved for very big occasions, but you could send a picture overnight from New York to Chicago and New York to Los Angeles, and they used that, needless to say, for both Lindbergh in 1927 and Babe Ruth in 1927, as well as Babe Ruth's mistress in 1925. But it was also the time when Madison Avenue was being created, when Edward Bernays and Ivy Lee were creating all the ways of selling people things they didn't know they needed, and when also marketing and the idea of how to shape a personality, shape a product. I mean, we call it branding today, but Babe Ruth was maybe the first brand ever.
And this guy, Edward Bernays, you talk about him as the person who essentially invented the notion of a celebrity pitch man. And Babe Ruth sold all sorts of stuff. I mean, he was a baseball player, but he was the Michael Jordan of his time, you know. Where do we put those Hanes on you or whatever Jordan commercials were. So heretofore, I mean, before Babe Ruth, companies just didn't think about using famous figures to hawk their products.
Well, they did, you know, in very small and limited ways, starting back in, I think, the 1880s, ballplayers first started appearing on the covers of cigarette packages. But in a systemic way and with an understanding of what it meant to put his big mug on the face of shaving cream, or, soap or Remington rifles, that was brand new. And it was done with the notion that you could get people to, you could appeal to people's unconscious desires to be like the Babe by selling them a product that they said he used.
So this notion of Babe Ruth as a PR phenomenon, as a marketing juggernaut, It was a product of his time.
Yes,
I mean, that was really what was. That's your point in this is this was happening concurrently. I mean, and that was somewhat serendipitous, right?
He was a lucky guy in lots of ways, but one of the ways was that there was an agent, a guy who was a failed PR man, a failed ad man, a failed account guy, a failed sports cartoonist named Christy Walsh, who was from Los Angeles and was an unusual thing, an Irishman who was both cheap and totally sober. And he came to New York, had just lost his job, and like everyone else, wanted a piece of the babe and was failing to get a piece of the babe. According to his nephew, Richard, what he did in desperation in February 1921 was climb up the fire escape outside the building that Babe Ruth was staying in, open the window to his hotel room, I think this would have been the Ansonia Hotel at 79th and Broadway, crawled through it, found Babe in bed with a blonde and said, "I want to represent you."
new meanings to taking a meeting, yeah.
He also slapped him on the butt, apparently, when he did it.
And Babe said yes.
And Babe said yes. I mean, he would have appreciated that kind of moxie. The story Christy Walsh told himself, because, of course, he's a PR guy, and so he told a zillion versions of this, was that actually he delivered beer to Babe Ruth's apartment by posing as a delivery boy. And that was, you know, in his memoir published in 1937 called Adios to Ghost. And but then again, there was another version, was that the delivery man in the published version doesn't show up for work and Christy volunteers to take his place. In the other versions, Christy paid the delivery guy not to show up.
Babe Ruth was all in with virtually any idea to get him in the papers and get him on radio. I mean, he used to carry around a phonograph machine and sing?
Well, he used to take it on road trips with him, and he would play it sometimes, you know, waiting for a train at Penn Station in New York. There's a famous example of him out west while they're waiting to change trains, and he takes it out and organizes a sort of impromptu dance and hootenanny.
It's like karaoke with Babe Ruth.
I never heard it put that way. That's perfect. He was perhaps the most game person in American history. You name it, he would do it. Including, in my favorite example of this, I tell about very early in the book, was in July 1926. On a blistering hot day, Walsh drags him out to a dusty airfield on Long Island, from which Charles Lindbergh would take off 10 months later, and decides that he's going to have Babe Ruth set a record for the highest ball dropped from an airplane caught by a guy with a baseball glove. Now, of course, there was no such record, but he invented it for Babe Ruth to break. And in doing it, he had this poor guy running all over the field, you know, in woolen uniforms, military uniforms, because it was a benefit for a civilian training camps. There was a pet project of Joseph Pershing's. And he signed bats for all the winners of these civilian camps. But it was ungodly hot, and the propellers are kicking up so much dust you can't see the barracks behind him. And finally, the pilot has to come down to a reasonable height. He starts way too high,
and they're dropping balls out of the plane for him to catch.
And he finally catches number 7, and and there's a fabulous picture of him sort of kneeling in the grass. It's just him and the airplane. The airplane's like soaring out of the frame at the top, and Babe's at the bottom on a, you know, sort of a diagonal, and it's perfect. It's the future that's, you know, soaring, and he's at the other end of it.
Is Christy Walsh as much a phenom as Babe Ruth? I mean, were there other PR pitchmen doing these wild ideas and coming up with these wild schemes to get publicity?
Well, there was a guy named Cash and Carrie Pyle, as we all remember, who promoted Red Grange and Suzanne Langlon, the tennis player. But Walsh made it a systematic enterprise. And he started with the premise that he was going to syndicate ghostwritten stories by ballplayers and, you know, other famous athletes and coaches. And that had been done as early as 1913, and it became a big issue in World Series play when the powers that were then objected to players writing things for the newspapers. But Walsh made it a huge enterprise. And remember, Babe Ruth leaves Baltimore in 1914 after playing briefly for Jack Dunn and the Baltimore Orioles. And this is before radio. There is no way for anybody at home, unless you've been at the ballpark that day, to hear his voice. So this ghost-written stuff, which people pretty much knew that he actually hadn't written, was still the only way you could hear his voice. And it filled that niche between 1919, when it really started getting going, and 1935 or so, when radio took over completely and obscured and eliminated the need for these ghostwritten columns.
And of course, the whole development of these ghostwritten columns very much affects sports journalism, journalism in general. You know, do we have these celebrities writing things, you know, or have people writing things in the voice of these celebrities and then, you know, printing that as gospel, et cetera, et cetera. So it affects journalism. It affects how the media covers sports and covers, you know, the news in general. It's a fascinating read. We're going to come back after a quick break and take some of your questions and comments and talk more about The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created. Jane Levy is my guest. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To drop us a tweet, it's @MiddayWYPR. You can also check us out on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, the immigration debate as it moves forward in the next 2.5 weeks and how the showdown between Donald Trump and Congress will inform American politics as the 2020 election season gets underway. My guest will be the Washington Post syndicated columnist and Brookings Institution scholar E.J. Dion, plus a new film chronicles the incredible career trajectory of Richard White, who was born into poverty in West Baltimore and who has established himself as a successful classical musician, the first African-American to earn an advanced degree in tuba performance. He is the subject of a new film called R.A.W., From Destitute to Doctorate, and we'll meet Richard White tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, we are talking about another young man from Baltimore who beat the odds to become one of the most celebrated figures in American history. The author and journalist Jane Levy is here. We're talking about her latest book, The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created. Ruth was the first person to hit 60 home runs in a season. He accomplished that amazing feat without the aid of steroids and not even wearing a batting helmet on September 30th, 1927, in a game against the Washington Senator. Here's a newsreel telling of that event.
Washington's Tom Zachary gets ready. Strike one is called. It's high, a ball. Zachary gets ready. The Babe has done it. 60 home runs in one season. One of the greatest records in baseball.
Yes. A slightly coked up reenactment.
I think the count's wrong.
Yeah, the count is wrong. The strike of the ball on the bat sounds like a rocket, for gosh sakes. If you would like to join our conversation talking about Babe Ruth and baseball history, American history with Jane Levy, our number 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's talk a little bit about his prowess as a hitter. Were there any players prior to Ruth who were as good or who were in that league? We certainly didn't hear about them because of the media circumstances of their era. But, you know, Ty Cobb, Honus Wagner, I don't know, whoever you, baseball players. And are there people since Babe Ruth that really are as good when it comes to the art of connecting the ball to the bat?
You know, sure, there were players who were as good at the game they played. Because Ty Cobb, for example, played a very different game. He played little ball. His job was to move batters and runners from place to place to place and to allow managers, including later himself, to move people around the bases like chess pieces. And what Babe Ruth did, basically beginning in 1918, 1919, was take the game out of the hands of the micromanagers in the dugouts who liked to organize the game as a kind of chess match. And, you know, why should I move a guy? Why should I hit the other way and move a guy from one base to another, station to station, when I can take a full swing and end this thing right now? It was an act
of... It's just so much more efficient that way.
It is. It was an act of audacity and imagination and defiance and complete originality. Mike Rizzo, the general manager of the Nats, has said to me, he was the original. And so when people say to me, will there ever be another Babe Ruth? Sure, it's in the nature of human beings to exceed what has come before. But no one will invent or reinvent, I don't think, baseball the way he did. He turned it into the power game that it is today. One of my friend, Michael Halpert, the economist who did all the money stuff in the book, and there's a lot of it showing just how much Christy Walsh, his agent, made for him. But Michael did this great thing, and I may misquote it, but if I do, I'll look it up and tell you. In 1918, you were more likely, an American was more likely to know one of the survivors of the Titanic than to have seen a home run in a baseball game. Because, you know.
So these were rare occurrences.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and they were usually inside the park kind of home runs, you know, especially in the beginning, it was still the dead ball era. So, you know, the idea that you could just send the ball out of the park was an act of a revolutionary. And he was an inadvertent revolutionary. He took on not just the, you know, field managers, but he took on the general managers. He took on the commissioner.
Commissioner of the league, right.
I mean, you know, he didn't have much patience for Kennesaw Mountain Landis, and I don't blame him. Because he, in one way that just absolutely astonished me, here he is in 1921 getting fined and suspended for barnstorming after the season because there was a crazy rule that said if you were on a World Series team, you couldn't do that, as if somehow they were going to dilute the product. And he said, that's crazy. You know, what we're doing, I think, is good for baseball. He had the vision to say, oh, my God, we're expanding the market way before the owners did.
You write, I think, really insightfully and elegantly, that Babe Ruth's power was the consequence of reflex and eyesight, coordination and strength, but also personality.
Yeah.
And this barnstorming thing, we should explain what barnstorming is.
Sure.
And he did this with none other than Lou Gehrig. The two of them went all over the country. People wanted to see this phenomenon. They wanted to see these home runs take place. They wanted to be there. They came to see him do this.
And to touch him, and to be near him, and to see whether he was really real, because what he was doing was so unprecedented. What he did, what? So, yes, barnstorming was an aviation term and borrowed later from by baseball players who would go from town to town to town in the off season with pickup teams and sometimes teammates, sometimes minor leaguers. And Christy Walsh in 1927, and this is the spine, the organizing principle of the big fella, organized the mother of all barnstorming tours, in which he took Babe Ruth and young Lou Gehrig, who is just 24, but the MVP that year because Ruth couldn't win it again under the rules that pertained. And they went all across the country, and everywhere they went, kids and a lot of grown-ups too would fall out of the stands trying to catch up with him as he made it around the bases. And in Trenton, the kids grabbed onto him after he hit his third home run off Dick Redding, a Negro League famous, fabulous pitcher near the end of his career. But, you know, he said, I was scared I would trample them with my spikes. And if you look at the picture that we used on the end papers of the book, which is, you know, those the edges of the hardcover, right? What you see is a picture from August 1925 where 5,000 boys in Syracuse fall all over themselves to try to get into this single frame with Babe Ruth. And look, they're draped over him like a cheap boa that a woman in a floozy on Broadway might have worn. And he is
smiling. He just loves every second of it.
He not only loves it, he needs it. This is the essential equation of why he was the best person, the inevitable person, to be the first media celebrity. Because this young man who had been sent off by his parents from downtown Baltimore to live and spend the vast majority of his childhood at St. Mary's Industrial School, which was then on the western cusp of Baltimore City, learned at that school not just how to hit and not just how to make a shirt collar, which he was being trained to do in case baseball didn't work out, and not just how to throw the hell out of a ball, because remember,
he was a good pitcher, too.
He was the best left-handed pitcher in the American League and might well have been a Hall of Famer at that. But what he also learned was how to be public, because those kids slept in long pinstripe rows of wrought iron cots, identically made up, with not a single bit of personal artifact, with just enough space between the rows to get down on your knees and say your prayers. They did everything together. They slept together. They bathed together to the extent they bathed. They ate together, albeit in silence. They played baseball together. And he learned that's what was normal for him was to be public. What was hard for him was to be private.
It's interesting because there are those you might imagine would have that experience and yearn for solitude. Lou Gehrig was exactly the opposite personality-wise. He was a mama's boy. I mean, he did not seek the limelight in any way. There are people who have a reaction to that that's completely different.
Yeah, I would find it completely claustrophobic. The New Yorker did Lou no justice in its first big profile of him, of saying he was the least fit to have a public of any celebrity. There's a cut for you. They were really opposites. Lou was the over-mothered, smothered boy from Upper Manhattan. Ruth was the motherless boy whose mother had been summarily dismissed from the family, and I guess we should talk about why and how, and ultimately she died in 1912. So he had no mother. His father never came to visit him at St. Mary's. So they were really two opposite sides of the coin.
I do want to talk about his Baltimore years. Let's go to the phones first to Michael in Mount Washington. Welcome to Midday with Jane Levy.
So hi there, Jane. Firstly, I've really enjoyed both of the books of yours. I read the Sandy Koufax and the Mantle book, and I'm really looking forward to reading this one. The question I had for you is this. I know that in the early 1900s, the ball player that most American kids looked up to was Christy Mathewson. And he was the Christian gentleman, and he was educated, and he was refined. And yet 20 years later, they're looking up to Ruth, who was not educated, who sort of lived a life of excess. And I'm wondering if that says anything about the American character, or is it simply because he was such a good baseball player, and that was a sport that all the boys followed?
Well, I think, and that's a great question, so thank you. I think that he was emblematic of the Roaring Twenties. You know, nobody roared more than the Babe. And at a time in American history where excess was the norm in a lot of places, he was more excessive than anyone else. I have to tell you, though, you know, he was abandoned by his parents to the brothers of the Xaverian order at St. Mary's, left alone at age 7 to create a life and a self. And damn it, he did it. You know, was he perfect? No. Did he learn how to be a good father and husband through that kind of upbringing? No. But, you know, he showed up every day. And he never stiffed anybody who wanted an autograph, albeit some of them were probably written by Pete Sheehy, the clubhouse guy for the Yankees. But I gained amazing amount of additional respect for him beyond what he did on the field because of how he had to invent himself.
So a patron of the St. Mary's Industrial School for Boys, this is a Catholic-run institution for white boys, who were deemed, quote, incorrigible or vicious or beyond control of their parents. So dad puts his son in this place, and as you mentioned, rarely if ever visits him. I mean, he shooed him out of the way as a child. I mean, you got to think that that is a trauma that no one would be able to recover from, or few would be able to recover from. But that was Ruth remained incredibly loyal to that institution through his whole life.
Yeah, and the story, you know, part of the challenge for me taking on the Babe was to try to do something different from what had come before, because God knows the guys who came before, the biographers like Bob Cremer et al. And Lee Montville, who's the last one, did a very good job in documenting his career and a lot of his life. But absent from virtually every one of those biographies is anything about the first 20 years of his life. And thanks to the availability now of digital collections of family documents and early newspapers, I was able to uncover the truth about his childhood, which was Dickensian. What happened to Babe Ruth was that on June 13th, 1902, a hot day in Baltimore City, he was taken off to St. Mary's. He was 7 years old, though he thought he was eight. His mother couldn't remember the year he was born, which was odd since it was the year of the February freeze in Baltimore when the entire harbor froze over. From the best we can tell, he was in and out a little bit for the next 4 years, but predominantly there. And then in 1906, his parents divorced. His father caught his mother in a compromising position with one of his bartenders, George Sowers, filed for divorce, and got custody of the three kids. That sealed Babe's fate. He was going to be at St. Mary's. Mamie, his only sibling to survive into adulthood, was pulled out of school at age eight to work doing the cooking that her mother no longer did of hot German potato salad and crab cakes. And the third child, who was alive in May 1906, would die 2 months later of starvation, a disease then called marasmus, at a facility that had been created for kids with abdominal distress. So it was somewhat outside of Baltimore. So here's a kid where you can document that they had six kids at least. Mamie always said there were eight, but I could only find six. And of those six, four died in infancy. So here's a young boy who has seen death over and over and over. And by the time he's sent away, you know, there's only three of them left. And after, you know, and they still don't want him. They still don't want him. So, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to say, what did I do wrong? You know, how bad could he have been? He was seven. He wasn't running. He wasn't a drug mule, you know. And all the mythology about this kid running amok on the Baltimore waterfront is nonsense. He didn't even live on the waterfront. And most of his early years, the first 6 years of his life, were spent in working class, stable neighborhoods where dads got up every day and went to work. It was only in 1902 when his father gave up his partnership with his brother in a lightning rod business and decided to open a bar on West Camden Street, that his childhood became anything like the myth that has been created around it. But I think he had no incentive, no reason to want to tell the truth. So that all through the years, when people would say, oh, you're an orphan, you know, because St. Mary's took orphans, he would say, no, I have parents, but he would never go any further. And when people would say he was an incorrigible, he would say, no, I wasn't an incorrigible, but never go any further. Because they're, you know, in that time in America, you didn't go on TV with Diane Sawyer and tell the sob story and get sympathy. You hid it.
Yeah, and you just created a new persona for yourself, which he did,
exactly.
You know, beautifully. We need to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about an interesting email from Mike in Hamden about race and Babe Ruth and Major League Baseball at the time. Jane Levy, the book is called The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created. You can join us at 410-662-8780. You can email midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. You can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Before we take a quick break, we note the passing of one of the great guys in local media, Dave Durian, the longtime radio host at WBAL, died yesterday of cancer. Dave and I both came to Baltimore in 1982, and our paths crossed many times before and after I began appearing as a host on WYPR. I have very fond memories of many occasions in which I appeared on a portion of the annual Center Stage auction with Dave. He was a terrific radio and TV professional. No one was cooler or more authoritative, whether he was delivering the news or talking of lighter matters. He was a man of unquestioned integrity, and it was always a delight to be with him. He will be missed by many. Dave Durian was 72 years old. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking with Jane Levy. She's an award-winning former sports writer and feature writer for The Washington Post, whose previous biographical subjects include Mickey Mantle and Sandy Koufax. She also wrote a baseball novel called Squeeze Play. Today, we're talking about her terrific new biography of Babe Ruth. Ruth was the first player in the history of the game to be known as much for his exploits off the field as he was for his Herculean achievements on the field. And he was the first player ever to make as much money off the field as he did in uniform. To read this book is to read a comprehensive and fascinating history of American celebrity, pop culture, and media. Levy says that nearly 100 years after his heyday, Ruth remains the lodestar of American fame. The book is called The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created, and last week it was chosen as a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. You are welcome to join our conversation with Jane Levy at 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org, our Twitter handle at midday WYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Jane, first of all, congratulations on the National Book Critics Circle Award. That's a big deal.
For biography.
For biography, for of biography. Course. But, you know, it's a great honor and well-deserved. This is a terrific read. Mike from Hamden sends an email, and I'm glad he did. He brings up a subject that I wanted to bring up as well. You mentioned Kennesaw Mountain Landis, the commissioner of baseball. Mike says, Landis was a virulent racist. Wasn't the main reason that he put a stop to barnstorming. These trips we were talking about that Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth would do, is that the major league stars played with and against people in the Negro leagues. So Landis always called them the N-word. And in fact, there's a story that you recount in a 1920 World Series in which people from an opposing bench were calling Babe Ruth the N-word. Race is very much a part of this time.
Yes, and thank you both to you and Mike. Let me straighten out a little of the details here. People debate how racist Kennesaw Mountain Landis was. He certainly didn't do anything to remove the color bar that prevented African Americans and people of color from playing in Major League Baseball. And he took advantage of Ruth's petulant decision to barnstorm in the offseason after the 1921 series as a method of consolidating his power over the game. The incident that you refer to, Tom, it was in the 1922 World Series. That was the last one played at the Polo Grounds when the Yankees and the Giants shared the space. So Babe Ruth had acquired this odious, you can't say nickname, a racial epithet that was attached to him that combined the N-word with other physiological traits at St. Mary's. It was something that the boys in the playground and the playing fields called him. It was based on only supposition and stereotype and bias, but it carried with him when he left St. Mary's and went to Boston, where he was called all sorts of names like Tarzan and ape, and people started saying that he wasn't really human. And the fact that so much was unknown about his childhood allowed speculation about his parentage to continue. People kept saying, well, he's an orphan. Who knows? Maybe his mother crossed over. So in the 22 World Series, John McGraw has this guy, Johnny Rawlings, on the bench, who is a sort of what we call today a super sub, though he had been a star of the previous World Series. And he starts baiting Babe Ruth from the dugout, calling him the N-word and whatever. At the end of the game, Ruth, who's having a terrible series and he has an infection in his elbow, barges into the Giants locker room, which is, of course, a violation of Major League etiquette, picks this guy up by the scruff of the neck and says, I guess I better not say what he said, huh?
No. Sorry.
And said, you can call me a bleep and you can call me a bleeper, just don't get personal, which caused the Giants to burst out laughing, and they thought he was, you know, being oversensitive. But you would be oversensitive at that time in that place, being called those racial epithets. And he turned to see that there was a whole phalanx of reporters, because after all, it was a World Series, standing there, and had heard the thing, and he pleaded with them not to report it. And in the ethos of the time, where reporters were much more complicit in protecting players, they didn't write it. It was written for the first time that I could find in a 1943 history of the New York Yankees by the great journalist Frank Graham, and then repeated in 74 by Bob Cremer in his fabulous biography. And every 10, 20 years, the speculation rears up again. So on October 15th, 1927, he and Gehrig stop in Kansas City to play a game. And it was one of the earliest ones organized, and that Christy Walss organized. And he had an agenda at every city, that an itinerary that, you know, from hospital to hospital to orphanage to hospital to, you know, the athletic center for lunch with the bigwigs in town.
And they had names for the teams. I mean, Gehrig's team was called the Larrupin Lous.
Larrupin Lous and the Bustin' Babes. And the games were played, you know, they were exhibition games. They were not high-quality baseball. People were there to see those two guys hit home runs and to see them, as I said before, in the flesh. So while they're in Kansas City, representatives from a Negro hospital for children, Wheatley Provident, reach Babe Ruth. How they did it, I don't know. But they get a hold of them and say, well, you've been to, you know, the white hospital. Can't you make time for us? And he goes. And the sports photography editor of the paper, George Cawthon, has given himself the assignment of following him around all day. And he takes this beautiful, beautiful picture of Babe Ruth holding a swaddled African-American infant against his massive chest. And it's sort of taken it, you know, he's standing one way and he's looking over his shoulder at the cameraman at Cawthon, and gives him this absolutely beaming smile. Now, Ruth had to know that a picture like that would once again cause the rumors about his ethnicity to, you know, proliferate. And in fact, the story was then later picked up in prominent African-American newspapers like the Chicago Defender, the Atlanta World. And, you know, and they started running stories. They ran the picture. No white papers did, you know, and he was a friend of the race. And that speculation never abated. He carried it with him for the rest of his career. His daughter, Julia, who is 102, still alive, believes that that's the reason he was never given a chance to manage, that the belief was that he would put blacks on his team. I don't buy that. I don't think he would have had that power. But I can't help but wonder whether the speculation about his ethnicity and all the racially coded language that described him as out of control and reckless with insatiable appetites also have sort of a racial undertow.
The book is called The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created. We're talking to Jane Levy about it. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Just have a few minutes left, Jane, but you mentioned the press. And you write that today's conflict of interest were yesterday's norms. There's a procedure called sugaring, where they'd pay money under the table to guarantee coverage of events or personalities or things. And there was a debate that developed, you know, were journalists cheerleaders or were they reporters? Were they going to be journalists who simply relayed what the facts were? And it was at this time that journalism really started to become journalism.
Yeah, I mean, the first tabloid in the United States was the New York Daily News, which went to press in June 1919. You know, and while it wasn't created for Babe Ruth, it might as well have been, because they debuted the back page for sports in November of that year. And here he comes in January, bigger than life and taking up a half of the back page of the Daily News. And he would fill it for the next 14 years. You know, it was the schism you're talking about is between the aw shucks and gee whizzers, that the two ends of the press box, one, you know, the Grantland Rices of the world who wrote poesies about, you know, the guys down on the field, the four horsemen and stuff, et cetera. And then the skeptics like Westbrook Pegler, who tried to lend some perspective at the risk of being perceived as curmudgeonly.
When he was highly paid, and he held out for more money, he was quite a negotiator when it came to his contracts and stuff. But you ultimately decide via a guy named Michael Haupert, who analyzed salaries and Ruth's salary, that ultimately it had no measurable effect on salaries in the major leagues, either during or even after his career. So his the fact that he was so highly paid, and he was paid highly as a pitchman, et cetera, that was not where the influence really lied.
Well, remember, you know, his career ends in June 1935. We're in the midst of the depths of the Depression. You know, paying athletes for endorsements at that point is not big on anybody's agenda, and athletic salaries, you know, in addition, needless to say, would fall. Ruth took to his grave the belief that he had changed the salary structure in baseball. And Michael Haupert, the economist from the University of Wisconsin, you know, has done all this research to show that it really didn't change. He certainly improved the lives of the New York Yankees, however.
Evie sends us an email. There's a baseball field in Frederick called McCurdy Field, where it's said that Babe Ruth started his career in the minors. Do you know anything about that?
Well, he started his career in the minors with the Orioles and would have played in Fayetteville, where they have a plaque saying he hit the longest home run. And then the stadium they played in Baltimore was over near Peabody Beverage Company, which I was just at last week. If that's where he hit the first home, if that's where he played his first Orioles game, I stand to be corrected and illuminated. I don't know.
Because he left St. Mary's, went right to the Orioles, and then within a few months was sold to the Red Sox, and then, of course, famously sold to the Yankees. And this all happened in a very short period of time. I mean, the time between boarding school, reform school, whatever you want to call it, and his, you know, huge career as a Major League Baseball player was not all that long, was it?
No, and you know, one of the beliefs about him that I was pleased to knock down is this idea that he emerged from St. Mary's like a caged animal being let out into the wilderness to forage and, you know, run rampant. The first thing he did when he got out of St. Mary's and moved to moved from Baltimore to Boston was get married. You know, it was his attempt to give himself the family life he had never had as a child. And that it didn't work, that he didn't know how to be a husband, that he didn't know how to resist temptation when it came his way, is hardly it's not hard to understand, and he's certainly not the only Major League Baseball player about whom you could say that.
Just have a few seconds left. I want you to weigh in on the called shot. There's controversy about this. Game 3 of the 1932 World Series, Wrigley Field. There is a theory that says he pointed to the stands. He says, this is where I'm hitting the ball. Do you think it happened, or do you think that's apocryphal?
Well, you know, there's a whole other version, the black version, which is that he was pointing at a black guy named Loudmouth Latimer, who was baiting him racially throughout the game. I love it that we're never going to know.
Yeah. Well, we will know a lot if you read this book. Jane Levy, I really appreciate it. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
The book's called The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created. A week from Friday, February 8th, Jane Levy will join a host of sports luminaries at a place called Game Baltimore. That's a sports bar on Warner Street here in town. And it's going to celebrate Babe Ruth's 124th birthday. We'll have a link to information at WIPR.org/midday. That's it for us today. Tomorrow on the program, E.J. Dion of the Washington Post joins me. We're going to talk politics. We're also going to meet a guy named Richard White. He's the first African-American musician to receive a doctorate in classical tuba performance. So that's all coming up tomorrow. I hope you can join us. We want to thank Joe Square for providing lunch today. They also provide catering and a party room for all your special events. You can find out more at joesquared.com. We want to thank you for listening. I'm Tom Hall. Here and Now is up next after the news at the top of the hour. Have a great day.
This is 88.1 WYPR.